sign, and then to be in Carolina in the morning.
In Carolina.
No one could be sweeter than McCready when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Joe Simpson with the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life in earlier times around North Carolina's Triangle area, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll be reading excerpts from West Hillsboro Origins, Stories and Poems by a Native Son, written by Charles B. Stanley. Standing on the precipice of Okeechobee Mountain in central North Carolina, one can see the westernmost part of the town of Hillsboro, a river meandering below, a railroad track, and perhaps hear the sound of a distant freight. To me, I see the origins of my 7 decades of time-space on this planet. Travel with me as I share poems and stories of West Hillsboro and beyond. From where I am standing, we can clamber down the south side of Okeechobee Cliff. There is an almost hidden path as we scramble, holding onto underbrush. We will faintly smell fern and musky mushrooms as we get closer to the hidden destination. The Panther's Den. In a favorite spot of my childhood, musky mushrooms and fern abound. There, a tiny cave is nestled under the wood, where a trickling spring is the only sound. In legend, the cave housed a wary cat that crouched above the rocky mound, then moved above where a resting man sat, where a trickling spring was the only sound. The surprised man with terror in his face arose to meet the fury's leap. The gun shattered the quiet of that place as the fierce feline fell in a lifeless heap. The Eno meanders far below. Animal trails that children found lead us back to long ago, where a trickling spring is the only sound. Leaving the panther's den and following the path beneath the cliff and above the Eno River, you get a sense of place. The river almost speaks as it moves slowly along. The river speaks. The river runs there, meandering through the vale. Birds flitter through the air, and I listen to its tale. It speaks in voice so low as it glides along the way, murmuring of long, long ago, of a distant, ancient day. Long before any men came, I gave life to others, the fox, bear, and other game. Then they were free brothers. Then I saw his face upon my shimmering breast. Reddish was his race, the forerunner of the rest.
Railroad Bill, Mustang on the hill, are rolling cigars out of pen.
Reflections from the Railroad. In West Hillsboro, looking north at the West Hill Avenue intersection with the railroad, one would today see a house on the left. In my mind's eye, I envision it as it was more than 50 years ago, the old C.E. Riley grocery store, but better known to me as Betty Riley's store. Betty was an attractive woman, the daughter of C.E. Riley, who had died several years earlier, leaving her the store. Later, she would marry Fred Seagroves. It was a bustling place where you could get groceries and about anything else needed. Mom never hesitated to send me there when she ran out of flour or tea. The store was a checker player's heaven. During the winter, grizzled old fellows played right inside the store, with the large glass windows giving them a projection encompassing their outside world. In summer months, the competition moved to the back porch of the store. Surrounded by empty boxes and the warm summer breeze, these guys spent hours and hours calculating the moves of friendly adversaries. I remember one sweltering summer day lingering on that porch. I watched what, to me, was not exactly invigorating action taking place between Dad and Mr. John Midget, the insurance salesman. There was an old pole holding up one corner of the porch roof. I was leaning against it when I became aware that my index finger had somehow gotten stuck in an insignificant drilled hole. Perhaps if I had been older than 9 at the time, a plan of escape would have come to fruition. However, I just stood there with my thoughts of doom. What if I never get my finger loose? Maybe someone will have to come and saw off the pole to free me. And what if the entire roof then comes down on my head? I tugged and twisted, and then I tugged and twisted some more. The cardboard cutout of Lola Albright, drinking Coca-Cola, perched on the back porch, stared smilingly down on my futile efforts. The 3 o'clock whistle at the Cone Mill Eno plant pierced the air and reverberated and echoed all around me. Soon, Dad would say that it was time to go home and help Mom fix supper. She would be waking from working the third shift from 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. My predicament was compounded when several of those first-shift workers emerged from within the store, Pepsis in hand, to watch the checker competition. None noticed me standing there leaning against the pole. If they had only known my agony within and without. I don't remember how or exactly when, but somehow about that time my finger slipped free. Dad never knew about my misery or the excitement of my escape. Just remember, no matter how bleak the future looks, there is always a better day ahead. Also, always be careful about sticking your fingers in the wrong places. I was lucky. I got mine back. Balancing on the rail of the track and covering about 200 yards walking east toward the depot, one can see the old church on the left. Facing the tracks and the once-thriving mill village on the other side, Eno United Methodist Church majestically stands as a sentinel to the past. Time changes the geographical landscape. During the 1950s, Cone Mill was faced with putting indoor plumbing in the houses of the Eno Mill Village. Rather than tackle that problem, Cone gave employees the opportunity to buy the homes for $25 a room, provided they would pay to have the houses moved to another location. It became an everyday occurrence to see a house moving down the road. Now, more than 60 years later, nature has reclaimed what was once its own. One can go to the old village site today and find sidewalks hidden beneath the foliage. Going from one level to another, cement steps, reminiscent of Inca ruins, lead present explorers to nowhere. The present Sunday school building adjacent to the Eno Church was one of those houses. It is almost like the church took one of its children and pulled it up close as a reminder of a childhood long ago. Doug Marlette, in his novel The Bridge, remarks, "The mill village is still there. It's just hidden under the kudzu." The village is still there for me, and it is hidden under the kudzu of my mind. Early West Hillsboro memories. Perhaps here I should give the reader a description of my family makeup. Mom and Dad had both been married previously. Mom was married to Lillard Medlin, and Dad was married to Sally Lindley. Both spouses died. Dad's name was Charles Bell Stanley, the same as mine. Mom's name was Myrtle. Her maiden name was Ray. Mom had 4 children, Francis, Phyllis, Thomas, and Mary Lou. Dad had 2 children, Buford and Pansy. Buford attended the Naval Academy in Annapolis. Pansy died of a cerebral hemorrhage the day I was brought home from the hospital. I remember people telling me how torn he was, being so distraught at the death of his daughter, and, on the other hand, being happy with the birth of a son. That must have been some ordeal. Dad was 57 when I was born, and my mom was in her late 30s. The very first thing I remember was a terrible accident involving my sister, Mary Lou. When she was 13, our brother-in-law, Lawrence Peck Albright, was making a potato storage bin in the old smokehouse when a nail he was driving flew up and pierced her eye. I can still picture Mama pulling the dress over her head to take her to the hospital. I was 3 at the time. Other early memories are associated with World War II. I remember my brother, Thomas, coming up to the back porch. He was wearing his uniform, and I remember jumping into his arms. It's funny that I don't ever remember any such embrace with him at any other time in my life. Somewhere in that same time frame, I remember the family gathering around an old Victrola and listening to a recorded message from Thomas that he had sent home from wherever he had been stationed. I wonder whatever happened to that recording, and was it a common occurrence? I do remember Mama was crying when she heard his voice. The railroad came within 200 yards of my house, and the sound of the outward bound made a lasting impression. Troop trains, with Sister Mary Lou chasing alongside, and the soldiers yelling at her, comes to mind. Train car after train car, carrying tanks, jeeps, and other military supplies, came by every day while I watched from the front steps of Eno Methodist Church, which faced not only the railroad but the mill village on the other side of the tracks. I remember my 5th birthday. All the church bells were ringing in the neighborhood, and car horns were blowing. I was so pleased that everyone was glad that it was my birthday. Later, I realized that May 8, 1945, was the day the Germans surrendered, ending that phase of World War II. In my mind's eye, probably when I was about 5, I see several men on a summer evening standing outside our bedroom window. Our radio was adjacent to the open screened window, and I remember hearing someone say, "Joe Louis is fighting tonight." Could it be in the mid-1940s there were people who didn't have radios that would have to come to a neighbor's house to hear the fight through an open window? Perhaps they were just having a boxing match get-together. Probably it was like tailgating without the food. Maybe there was a drink or two. This reminds me of my childhood radio shows. I guess the most impressive to me was The Lone Ranger, with his faithful Indian friend, Tonto. A cloud of dust and a hearty hi-ho, Silver! I travel back to those thrilling days of yesteryear. I had a bike that I named Silver, even though it was red. Who could ever forget the sound of the creaking door in The Inner Sanctum? Terror came into my room at night in the time before child ratings. Of course, there was Fibber McGee and Molly. I still remember they lived on Wistful Vista Drive. Mom always listened to Ma Perkins and Portia Faces Life. Every evening we tuned into One Man's Family and heard the announcer say, "Tonight we're listening to Book 23, Chapter 9, in the life of One Man's Family." The sound of the whine of an angry stinging insect precluded the beginning of The Green Hornet with his valet, Cato. The news was always brought to you by H.V. Kathenborn. He was the Walter Cronkite of his day. Nothing could beat the imagination that radio brought to our lives. I remember an episode of The Lone Ranger when he came to town disguised as an old man. The sound of his aged feet shuffling on the wooden streets of the town was very convincing. When he gathered the information he needed, the resounding sound of the strong footsteps of our hero of yesterday echoed iconically through my mind, and I can still recall the sound today. I was somewhat disappointed when Clayton Moore played the Lone Ranger role on television. On the radio, he was immortal. TV just didn't provide the imaginative thrill given to us by the radio. Dad was a boxing fan. We were not the first in the neighborhood to get a television. To my best recollection, Wednesday night fights were sponsored by Pabst Blue Ribbon, and the Friday night contests were brought commercial-wise by Gillette Razor Blades. On Wednesday night, we went to George Dabb's house, which was about one block east of Allen Ruffin Avenue. The house may have been owned by the Spoons. Mabel was George's sister-in-law. Her brother, Junior, was usually there, smoking a big cigar. George worked at the train depot. I remember jokingly asking him, "George, when does the 7 o'clock train run?" He would reply, "Charles, sometime around 7:30, if we're lucky." Those were fun times. I guess I was about 10 years old and felt a bond with those guys. I collected Ring magazine issues and would cut out pictures of my favorite boxers and put them on the wall. I could name the top 10 fighters in about every weight division. I knew about their families and their records. Mom always said that Dad missed a lot, meaning there were some things he was really oblivious about. On Friday nights, Dad would take me to Jim Fawcett's house to watch the Friday night fights. I remember one evening being aware of people going to bed while Dad and I sat there. He never seemed to get the hint that it was time to go home. Maybe Mom was right. Linda, to this day, thinks I picked up some traits of my dad. Oh well, perhaps ignorance really is bliss. Later, when we got our first television set, the test pattern took up part of the day. Dad always tried to adjust the television by smacking it on the top, or jiggling a few knobs, with the hope that his efforts would make the test pattern go away. I remember WFMY Channel 2 as being the first area station. When 11 o'clock p.m. came, the national anthem was played, and then the test pattern appeared and remained until programming returned at 6 a.m. My, how times have changed.
Sister's got to walk.
The river ran through us. Many of us West Hillsboro kids learned to swim in the Eno River. There were other places, like Sparrow's Pool in Chapel Hill, Hogan's Lake, or the annual church summer trip to Pullen Park in Raleigh. But each of those excursions were away from the neighborhood. The river ran through us. There was a mountain swimming hole located at the base of the towering quarry cliff. I can picture a rope swing there. That's where most of the mountain village guys swam. Up the river a ways, on the other side, between the Eno Mill Bridge and the Coon Rock, was Sandy Beach. That's where I learned to swim. Why they called it Sandy Beach, I'll never know. All I remember was a makeshift ladder, the proverbial rope swing, and, of course, the feeling of mud squishing between your toes on the bottom of the river. No sand. Clothing was always optional, and often no option at all. Most of the New Hill and the Old Hill guys swam there. There were stories of older brothers taking younger siblings, throwing them in the water and yelling, "Okay, you gotta sink or swim." I don't remember anyone drowning there, and that method for teaching youngsters to swim is very motivational. I never saw anyone swimming at the Coon Rock, but there is a story about Freck Dollar diving off the top of the rock into the shallow water and actually breaking some bones in his neck. He walked around quite a while with one of those neck braces. One would hear, "Did you know that Freck broke his neck at the Coon Rock?" Before the Ben Johnson Dam was built at the first bridge, the old Dimmock's Mill Rock Dam stood for many years. I remember as a young kid some people swimming there. I believe it was Evelyn Cox who screamed as she floated by me in the shallow water, "I found a tick! I found a tick!" I must have been about 6 years old at the time. Funny how you don't forget some things. Dad liked to fish at the Coon Rock. He was a patient fisherman and could sit there all day. He would put dough on his hook with that old cane pole and fish for what he called suckers. He said he never wanted to go to the ocean and fish because he was told that you just had to throw in your line and a fish would bite the bait right away. He thought that would have taken all the fun out of it. So he sat, and he sat, and he sat. I don't think it would bother him if he sat all day and got nothing. He said it was all in the anticipation of what might happen. I'm not much of a fisherman, but I did have some fun times. One exciting experience happened under the second bridge. That is the one up past the Ben Johnson Dam. If you're standing on the second bridge and look north, you can see the 90-foot trestle where the cow made a famous plunge. But that story is to come. Back to the fishing story. Hurley Dickey was the father of Joe and Marvin, and he probably wasn't aware that he was a second father to me. I was really overjoyed to be invited on a night fishing venture at the second bridge spot. When I got there, Hurley brought out several Clorox jugs. We all got busy tying hooks around the top of them and baiting them with huge squirming worms. We three guys got in the rowboat and set the jugs from the bridge all the way down to where the 7 Mile Creek joined up with the Eno. When we got back, Hurley had built a fire, and we roasted hot dogs and marshmallows. To me, that was a great feast. After about an hour or two, the only light was the full moon that was reflecting off the unforgettable scene of Clorox jugs darting this way and that up and down the river. Hurley said, "Okay, boys, go get your fish." We had no idea what we had snared. Joe pulled out a flashlight as we rowed toward the first jug. Grabbing it by the handle, Marvin pulled it out of the water. We all screamed at the same time, thinking it was a snake, but actually, it was an eel. At that moment, I didn't rightly know what the difference was. Later, a huge turtle made it to the bottom of the boat. We were scurrying around, trying to get out of its way, almost tipping the boat. Believe it or not, we did catch a mess of fish, brim, smallmouth bass, and catfish. When we got back with our haul, Hurley had the frying pan hot, and after cleaning the fish, we had quite a meal. We didn't eat the turtle. We turned it and the eel loose.
Whitey wire green, my dear, oh, whitey wire green, Jenny Jenkins.
The Depot. From the railroad crossing, looking for about a quarter of a mile, one can see the overpass and the location of the former depot. Nowadays, this is the entrance to Gold Park. The overpass holds a fearful memory for me. I remember riding the school bus when the teenaged driver decided to drive the bus through the wrong side of the posts holding it up. There's a sharp curve there, and if something had been coming, a tragic collision could have occurred. Fortunately, no one was coming, and the young man just laughed and laughed. There's always a threat when one takes his life in his own hands, but how helpless is the feeling when someone else takes your life in his hands? An early memory of the depot is going with my mother to Durham for Christmas shopping. There was no car in our immediate family. In the early 1940s, there were separate waiting rooms for whites and coloreds. The same was at the Durham station when we got there. Later memories were closely tied to my newspaper route. The Durham Morning Herald was brought there about 5 o'clock in the morning. Buster Davis and I would meet there. He carried to one section of West Hillsboro, and I had the Eno Mountain part. I remember once we got to the depot before the delivery guy got there. We climbed up on top of the depot and threw pebbles at him in the darkness. He kept looking around, shrugged his shoulders, and got in his car and drove away, never knowing it was us or where we were. The paper boy. I don't remember how I got the carrier job, but it was my first work for pay. I think my half-sister Phyllis knew the delivery guy. I guess I was about 13, and I carried it until I graduated from high school. It had rained heavily the night before my first morning on the job. When crossing the Eno River Bridge to the Mountain Mill Village, the eerie sight of the river over its banks greeted me. Reflections from the streetlights illuminated the fast-running waters during the early morning hours. One morning, while approaching the depot, I saw a body lying under the streetlight at the corner adjacent to the railroad station. I didn't know if the man was drunk, or possibly even dead. I had to go around the figure to get to my papers. Quietly, I tiptoed to the farthest side of the street. Suddenly, to my horror, the individual leapt to his feet and ran toward me. "Good morning, Charles," shattered the quiet, as Bryant Buster Davis greeted a breathless me. Buster was always doing something like that. One morning it was a drunk person staggering from one side of the road to the other, and just as he stumbled toward me, I heard again, "Good morning, Charles." The newspaper at the depot sometimes transferred scary moments from its pages to the hair on the back of my neck. One such occurrence was the headline that screamed, "Beast of Bladenboro Strikes Again." Evidently, some horrendous creature was killing livestock and pets in the town of Bladenboro. Now, I didn't know where Bladenboro was, and I'm still not really sure. The morning I read those headlines, it was wherever I was. Imagine taking that story with you as you walked through the early morning fog toward the Mountain Mill Village. I kept looking over my shoulder and becoming alert to every strange sound. Suddenly, I heard a distinct woof behind me. I turned to see the biggest dog I had ever encountered in my life. He growled again, then I screamed and jumped about 5 feet into the air. I went one direction, and the dog went the other. Looking back, he was probably more scared than I, but that was probably impossible. Tommy Smith lived, or at least slept, in the abandoned Gem Theater in West Hillsboro. He was a boisterous, outgoing, friendly person. He was a great paper customer. I would toss the news through the crack in the door and continue my route. Timing is always important in any facet of life, and getting paid by Tommy was a dilemma in orchestration. If I could reach him immediately after payday, I was okay. He paid happily. If I missed it by a few hours, his money was already invested in a weekend of heavy drinking. He probably still owes me money. My brother-in-law, Kenneth Hicks, remembered his Navy experiences and was stationed briefly in California. He saw no one he knew for months, and then one day, as he was coming off his ship, he heard, "Hey, Hicks!" Well, lo and behold, it was Tommy Smith, 3,000 miles from home, giving him a thrill and sense of place. Tossing the newspaper is a lost art. I'm surprised they never suggested entering the skill in the Olympic Games. Some carriers were masters of sailing that morning paper right up to the customer's door. Unfortunately, I was not one of them. The Walters house was my toughest challenge. Thelma Walters was my first love. She never knew it. She worked at the savings and loan, and I opened my first savings account there only because she greeted me at the counter. I really wanted to get her newspaper right up to her door. However, the yellowing memories of past failures were spread all over her rooftop. One morning, a miracle occurred when an errant flight sailed right into an open bedroom window. Now that was service with a smile. Across the street from the Walters house was the home of Sally Allison. Years after my paper-carrying days were over, I wrote this tribute to her in The News of Orange. Anyone who ever rode through West Hillsboro probably saw the lady sitting on her porch in a favorite chair, returning a friendly wave of her hand. I read today that Miss Sally Allison, age 92, would no longer be the official greeter from her front porch or Eno United Methodist Church, where you regularly found her. The paper said she died Monday, September 29th. The article was too short. I was Sally Allison's paper boy many years ago. It was a joy to stop by her house on Saturdays. She had a way of making people feel good about themselves. Another blessing came my way on Sunday because many of us were fortunate to attend church with her. Years passed. Some of us moved away. When we came back for a visit, Miss Sally made us feel that we hadn't really left. In a time of change, let us be thankful for people who are constant and real. Sally Allison was such a person. Her life was an inspiration, and her memory a benediction. There were other paper boys during that period. Jack and Jean Knight delivered to Hillsboro proper, the historic part of town, referred to by future co-teacher Hiram Coble as Hysteric Hillsboro. Jim Parsley also delivered papers to downtown Hillsboro. A paperboy considered a legend in his time was Wayne B.T. Johnson. William Parker went out one cold Sunday morning and couldn't find his paper. Across the bottom, he could see Wayne in front of Butch Rayner's store, throwing papers into an old burning trash barrel to keep warm. One of them must have been William's. One Saturday, while collecting his money in the Mountain Mill Village, Wayne repeatedly knocked on a door. Finally, he grabbed a loose board on the side of the house, pulled it back, and released it with a loud blam. Over and over, the sound echoed across the river and around the neighborhood. He then yelled, "I know you're in there. Come out and pay me." Someone finally came to the door. Wouldn't you? The last day I carried the paper before leaving for college, Buster and I met at the depot about 5 a.m. I brought one half of a watermelon, and he brought some Pepsis, and we celebrated our time together, knowing that our paths were separating far more than just carrying the papers in different sections of town. I look back with some nostalgic sadness on that moment in time. In the 1958 Silhouette Hillsboro High School yearbook, in the Senior Last Will and Testament section, you will see the following. I, Charles Bell Stanley, will to Buster Davis all of the wonderful and pleasant memories of me, that is, if he should consider them as such. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Following the broadcast, this episode is readily available as a podcast on our website, trianglereadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138.